My name is Tom Powers. Along with Mr. Williams here, we represent the Petitioner Steering Committee, as well as William Meade and Jordan King and their individual claims in this proceeding. The initial portion of your presentation today and a significant portion of the report that you filed discuss the 2001 medical hypothesis article, correct?
That's right.
And in your direct testimony, you described that article as the reason that we're here today, correct?
That was the first suggestion anyone had ever, the first time to my knowledge that anyone had ever suggested that thimerosal and autism had a relationship.
In preparation for your expert report, did you review the expert reports that were submitted by the petitioner's experts on general causation in these cases?
Yes, I did.
Did you review Dr. Deeth's report?
Yes, I'm not a biochemist, so that one's really out of my area of expertise.
Did you review Sandra Greenland's report?
Yes, and again, I'm not an epidemiologist, so that one's also out of my area.
Did you review Dr. Posian's report?
I did.
In none of those reports was the article that you referenced cited or relied on. Is that correct?
I don't remember whether it was or not. It wouldn't necessarily have been.
And your understanding would be that those materials laid out petitioner's theory of general causation in these cases, correct?
Yes, that the expert reports did.
Between the time that you filed your expert report and your direct testimony today, did you have chance to review Dr. Kinsborn's expert report submitted?
Yes.
Dr. Kinsborn's report didn't cite the Bernard article that you've been discussing at all, did it?
I don't think so.
None of the general causation reports from petitioners in these cases cite or discuss the Bernard article, correct?
I'm not sure, but if you say so, I will agree.
Now, in a lot of the work that you've done, it appears that there's an effort to look at minor physical abnormalities and see if there are associations between those MPAs, is that the right abbreviation?
Yes.
Between MPAs and autism, is that a fair statement of a fair amount of your work?
Some of it.
You've also done brain pathology work?
Mm-hmm.
In the brain pathology work, how many brains have you actually examined tissue from and done generated peer-reviewed published literature?
Just one.
One brain. In the literature that you reviewed that describes the brain pathology work of others, would that involve the same series of studies that Dr. Kemper testified about yesterday?
Yes. I mean, I've read all of those, yes.
Okay. And as he described, those studies involved a total of 23 individual brains, correct?
Yes.
You need to stop.
Yeah, and I was going to say that the special master was about to signal you. When you give an answer, you need to say yes or no, okay, because this is being recorded and we've got to have a good record. So, again, the question was, the brain pathology literature that you're relying on is essentially the same series of reports that Dr. Kemper described based on 23 brains.
Yes.
So your work in neuropathology has involved the 23 brains in those studies and the one brain that you looked at, correct?
Well, my understanding of the neuropathology involves all of those.
Okay.
And I'm sure he was including my case in the 23.
That I think he was, and he actually did describe some studies that had individual, that were just single brain case
yes.
studies. Now, in those neuropathology studies, there was no correlation made between the neuropathology observed and the particular symptoms that the person from whom that brain was taken presented with, was there?
I don't recall any very extensive discussion of the symptoms. In the Bailey case, there was probably a little more discussion of each individual case's symptoms, but all of them were ones that met the criteria at that time for a diagnosis of autism.
So it would be fair to say that the neuropathology to date that you've reviewed and that you've relied on cannot correlate neuropathological findings with a specific mix of symptoms in any particular person, correct?
You certainly can't account for all the symptoms with the neuropathology, but I think in our report, We certainly had evidence that the things we were seeing in the brain were having effects in the person. For example, that she had poor control of the muscles of facial expression. In fact, she had what's called Mebius syndrome, which is lack of innervation to the face and to the lateral rectus muscle that moves the eye to the side. And we didn't have the tissue to look at her abducens nucleus that moves the eye to the side, but we did have the tissue to see that her facial nucleus didn't contain the normal number of cells.
But in this one brain and this one particular symptomology, you had a correlation, mm-hmm. you believe. In general, the neuropathology has not been able to describe any particular pattern of symptoms that are associated with particular pathologies, correct?
In general, but I can tell you one that's from our work that I didn't include in my report.
Is this the Brazilian Namibius work?
No. This is the eye blink conditioning that I mentioned yesterday. It has been shown in many of the neuropathology studies that the number of Purkinje cells in the cerebellum are reduced. And in eye blink conditioning, we know that the Purkinje cells provide the control of the timing of the eye blink response and the size of it. And in people with autism, they blink a little too early and they blink harder than most people. And so that shows that there's something amiss with the Purkinje cells.
Now, eye blinking rate and strength of eye blinking, is that part of the diagnostic criteria for autism?
No.
In terms of the diagnostic criteria for autism across the three domains, did any of your work show that there is a correlation between the neuropathology and particular presentation of language skills in individuals with autism?
No.
Any work that associates particular neuropathologies with the presentation of behavioral skills in particular individuals with autism?
I'm not sure what you mean by behavioral skills.
We're talking about the behavioral skills that are one of the domains that are assessed in diagnosing autism.
You mean social behavioral skills or communicative behavioral skills?
More the play and behavioral skills.
That's considered a social skill.
And there's no correlation between the neuropathology and any collection of symptoms in any individual with autism?
No, because none of the symptoms that are used in diagnosis are associated with any particular region of the brain. No one knows what part of the brain controls peer relationships or imaginative play.
No correlation between the timing of onset of symptoms and any particular manifestations of the neuropathology, correct?
If I understand your question, and I'm not sure I do, Dr. Kemper said yesterday, and I've said today, that there are many things in the pathology that suggest a very early origin of the injury.
But there's nothing that associates specific symptoms that would be diagnosed in any individual with the neuropathological findings. You're saying it suggests an early onset. But my question is, does any of the neuropathology correlate with specific patterns of symptoms of people diagnosed with autism?
I would say no.
And that would be reflected in the DSM-4 criteria, correct? Where there's, we talked about this with Dr. Kemper and you were here yesterday, where there no specific pattern has been identified correlating any neuropathological issues with the presentation of symptoms, correct?
Not with the diagnostic symptoms.
Right. You talked about neural lesions. In what percentage of human beings who have been diagnosed with regressive autism is there evidence of neural lesions in their brains?
No one, to the best of my knowledge, has done any pathological work where they took cases who were regressive and compared them to others.
So the answer would be no. There's no instance of a person with regressive autism who's been found to have a neural lesion.
No.
You talked about environmental factors that may contribute to autism. You had it in your report, and you described that on direct testimony. Do you have your report in front of you?
I do.
I'm going to ask you to turn to page 4 of the report.
Okay.
Okay. There's a subheading B, and it says, the known environmental risk factors for autism all act in the first trimester of pregnancy. When you say known environmental risk factor, what are you referring to? What, as you describe it here, what attributes of a risk factor are there in order for it to be known, as you describe?
That it's been demonstrated in an epidemiological study, a population study.
So your description of risk factors here is limited to risk factors that have been examined in population studies, in ecological studies?
Not correct? Ecological studies, but population studies.
Population studies. So are you excluding case series and case studies from your description of environmental risk factors here?
I'm not aware of any of those in that speak to the issue of environmental factors.
Are you familiar with any case reports or case studies that associate malaria in young children with the later presentation of autistic symptoms?
Actually, I have seen some of those.
Are you familiar with studies that describe the possible implication of other viruses, such as Borna virus, in the later development of autism postnatally in children?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Are you aware of any case studies that describe encephalopathies, acute encephalopathies postnatally, that are then associated with the later development of autistic symptoms?
With the subsequent development of autistic symptoms.
Correct.
There are a few of those cases in the literature, but I believe that they are examples like the example I gave you of tuberous sclerosis, where if you injure the brain enough, you will eventually produce some of the symptoms of autism.
Right, and these are cases that do describe postnatal injuries or events that produce autism, correct?
With very, very severe brain damage.
As I take it from looking at your work, one of the theories that you've advanced is that there are the possible involvement of the hindbrain or the brainstem in early development and the later development of autism. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in examining that hypothesis that fetal midbrain hindbrain or brainstem development might be associated with later autistic symptoms, you looked at potential genetic contributions to that etiology. Is that correct?
Yes, and many of the genes that have been proposed as candidate genes for autism susceptibility are early developmental genes involved in the formation of the brainstem.
Right, and my understanding is that a number of years ago, you published a paper that examined a particular genetic location, the homeobox A1.
That's right.
It's a particular location on chromosome 7. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that particular coding section codes the proteins that help guide the early alignment and development of, is it the hindbrain or the brain stem?
It's the brain stem.
So you published on that, and one of the hypotheses there was that variations in the, is it HOXA1, is that the easiest way to?
HOXA1.
HOXA1, thank you. The more that I can use abbreviation scientifically, the more I appreciate it. So the HOXA1 coding site on chromosome 7, the hypothesis was that anomalies there might be associated with autism down the road. Correct?
Right.
And there was a series of papers that were published after your article that addressed that question, correct?
Yes.
And in 2002, Professor Lee's article came out, and that article held that it's unlikely that the HOXA1 findings play a significant role in a genetic predisposition to autism, correct?
That's right.
There was another article that came out also in 2002 with a larger study, and that study concluded that even though they had the study had enough power that they were 95% confident they could identify even a 1% contribution of HOXA1, they concluded that the evidence didn't support an association, correct?
That's right. And these are papers on the same polymorphism in HOXA1 that we had examined.
Right. And then in 2004, a third paper came out saying that the HOXA1 gene is unlikely to be a susceptibility gene for autism, correct?
Mm-hmm. And then in 2005, a group of patients were studied in Saudi Arabia and Turkey who had a larger polymorphism or mutation in HOXA1, and it turned out that they did have autism.
And in all of these studies, it hasn't been described as causing autism, but as a genetic susceptibility or a genetic vulnerability to autism.
That's right.
There was a study that you did, Nova Scotia?
Yes.
Okay. And this is Respondents Exhibit 401. And it's going to be on your screen in just a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Now take a look at that screen. And I'll just ask you, what does that appear to be on your screen?
That's our paper from Teratology in 1997, I think.
Okay. Now, what I would like to do is turn to the, and again, this is Respondents Master List 401. We're going to turn to page 3 of the exhibit. And, Doctor, for ease of your reference, the text page in the report is 321. And there's a table there. I wanted to zoom in for a second on table 2.
Okay.
And that very first category there where it says ear rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the ear dysmorphology that you were describing in your slide presentation?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And you found that in this population of children in Nova Scotia, that 42% of the autistic children had the ear rotation that you described, correct?
Yes.
Now, 18% of the controls also had that, true?
That's right.
So is it your hypothesis that whatever genetic coding going on in early development that produced the ear rotation malformation also produced autism?
I think that... Could you rephrase that question?
Is it your theory that the same genetic coding that directed the ear rotation resulting in this malformation also caused autism?
We don't know whether it was genetic or not. I showed you that these malformations can also be caused by environmental factors. So we don't know whether these were genetically caused or not. But we think that they're related, that the timing, since there's evidence that something went wrong in development, that it's most likely that that's when the autism started.
Now, the 18% of the controls that had this this identical... It's called a malformation, just that's different in degrees of ear rotation. 18% of the controls had that. Now, they did not have autism.
That's right.
So there's something that happened differently with the controls than with the autistic children. Even though they had the same dysmorphology and they had very different outcomes, correct?
Yes.
So at best, any of the early developmental processes that generate these malformations would indicate not that that process caused the autism, but that it was a susceptibility or vulnerability to the later development of autism, correct?
I think it speaks more to the issue of there being some event early on that seems to be related to the autism.
And some event early on that at least given the evidence that controls who experience the same event don't develop the symptoms, at least leaves open the possibility that something that happened later affected the ultimate presentation of symptoms in the children that were autistic, correct?
Yes, that's possible.
Okay.
But in science, we strive for parsimony, and if you already know that there was an event that did something to disturb development, you don't propose that there was probably a second event, unless there's evidence for it.
Now, would you disagree, and we're done with the paper here, would you disagree with anybody who presented at the Institute of Medicine, the meeting in April of 2007, that looked at the issue of potential environmental contributions in the etiology of autism? Do you disagree that there may be environmental factors that come into play in autism?
No.
You don't disagree?
No.
Would you agree that it is possible and biologically plausible that in some cases there could be postnatal environmental factors that might result in the appearance of autistic symptoms?
It's a very outside possibility that a very late injury, unless it's overwhelming brain injury like with an encephalopathy, that a very late injury would give you the same behavioral effects that you see after early injuries.
Would you disagree then with the recommendation that NIH, at least the person who was Dr. Insel, who was presenting, that NIH ought to be devoting research money into postnatal environmental contributions to the development of autistic symptoms? Do you think that that's a waste of money?
I certainly wouldn't say that no one should try to study it, but given how successful it's been so far, I would doubt that it would be very successful in the future.
Any of the work that you've done in looking at dysmorphology, a question also on the dysmorphic issue, what percentage of children with regressive autism have dysmorphic physical features?
I am not aware that anyone has ever looked at has reported physical dysmorphologies in regressive versus non-regressive cases.
Among cases that are non-regressive, what percentage of non-regressive cases of autism have identified dysmorphologies associated with them?
I think it depends on who's looking for the dysmorphologies and which ones they're looking for. But I know in our sample, we've run around 50% have dysmorphic features of some sort. And in the cases in Rome collected by Tony Persico, he says 52% in his sample.
So it sounds like about half. Correct?
Yes.
So, and those are specifically in the non-regressive cases, but again, in the regressive cases of autism, you're not aware of any data that even associates the appearance of physical dysmorphologies with the symptoms of regressive autism, correct?
No, I'm not. But both Persico's series and ours would have included some cases of regressive autism.
Do you know that?
Let me interrupt. That's the point I wanted to make to your previous question, Mr. Power. You asked her, she said there was no difference between regressive and non. She didn't know that anyone had looked at regressive versus non-regressive. And then you asked her, well, in the cases of non-regressive, and you said Dr. Rodier said about 50%.
But no, he said that was in non.
I'm sorry?
He said that that was in non-regressive.
Well, actually, in the question before you answer, I think he said he mentioned it too, and I didn't think you picked up on it. So if I want to make sure I understand. When you were talking about the studies that have found about 50 or 52%, those studies made no distinction between regressive or non-regressive.
That's correct.
All right. I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay. So they made no distinction, and so the issue is that an association of physical dysmorphologies with regressive autism is an inquiry that has yet to been made. Is that a fair statement?
That's right.
Right. Thanks. No further questions.
Go ahead.
Just a couple. Doctor, you were asked some questions about your own brain studies, and you were asked how many you had studied, and you answered one. Based on your study of that brain, did your findings make sense biologically? In other words, did the things that you found match up with what is kind of scientifically understood about biology and development?
Yes.
So even though your data is limited, it is consistent with other established scientific data?
Yes. And I should say, I think this is an important point. The different histological studies that have been done all have their strengths and weaknesses. We had just one case, but we did serial sections of that case. That is, we had just part of the brain, and so it wasn't that expensive to do thin serial sections of the whole length of the tissue that we had. In most studies of larger case series, in Dr. Kemper's set, their sections are incredibly thick, so they have difficulty studying small nuclei, whereas we could study that. In Bailey's case, they couldn't afford to take sections except every couple of millimeters, so they didn't even have a chance to hit most of the small nuclei that are smaller than a couple of millimeters. So those studies are good because they have multiple cases, but they're bad because there are a lot of parts of the brain they couldn't study.
But in general, is the study of these brain sections, is it fairly painstaking?
Yes, okay. Especially if you're doing cell counts. Okay.
And in the studies that have been done, are the findings generally consistent between the brains that have been studied?
Some of the things are fairly consistent, especially the low number of Purkinje cells. But there are other things that one person has reported and no one else has reported. But this is a very slow process. I'll give you an example. One of the things we found in the brain that we studied was a complete absence of a part of the superior olive, which is an auditory relay nucleus, and it's the first one where information from both ears comes together in the nervous system. And so it's important in sound localization. Okay? And we reported that. It was very striking in our brain. No one else has ever reported it. No one else has said that the superior olive was normal. They just didn't look. And just 2 months ago, a group of people who actually study the superior olive got hold of the superior olive from one of the brain banks for five cases. And in fact, all five of them were abnormal. So that's an example of something that was reported in 1996. No one else saw it until 2008.
Doctor, you're also asked some questions about the environmental risk factors that you identified and why you selected the ones that you selected. And I just wanted to be clear, did you select the ones that you presented today because there's good epidemiological data on those?
Yes.
Okay. And so you weren't considering case reports and case studies because those don't really provide good evidence of a causal association.
No.
And doctor, I just want to ask you, as a scientist who studies human development, what's more likely, that early problems in prenatal development cause problems later in development, or that a postnatal exposure causes autistic progression?
Early injuries produce a cascade of further injuries in the nervous system, and this has been shown many times. So I would favor the idea that early injuries are the most likely to be involved.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Powers, anything further?
We have no further questions, Special Master.
Special Masters?
I have a question probably several for you, Dr. Rodier. My questions deal with some of a follow-up on some of Mr. Powers' questions. That is, We have heard testimony or read reports that involve people with postnatal exposures to certain viruses or other factors that develop who develop autistic-like symptoms. Herpes encephalitis, for example. Given your testimony that the onset of the injury occurred probably in early prenatal development, how do you square that with evidence that something postnatally can cause very similar symptoms?
I think that in those rare cases, like the malaria cases, the herpes encephalitis cases, that what you get is tremendous brain damage, and it probably includes many symptoms besides the symptoms of autism. But if you damage the brain enough, you'll eventually damage the parts involved in autistic behavior. Although it actually won't be, technically wouldn't meet the present criteria for autism unless it occurred before age 3.
Age 3, right. So you're saying that a postnatal insult that involves incredible brain damage can mimic the symptoms, but although having a very different cause from what you see in terms of classically diagnosed autism.
Right. I'm making that distinction because I think the thing that is fascinating to scientists is that the symptoms of autism can occur in someone who has no other symptoms at all. That we have a case in Rochester who has an IQ of 150 but has frank autism. So, you know, many cases of autism don't look like they have overwhelming brain damage, but they have some alteration in their development that interferes with very specific kinds of behaviors. And I think that people who work in autism, that, you know, that's the thing that they're trying to understand.
So I think an analogy, so let me give you this. Let's say that a child suffers a postnatal insult, or a prenatal insult, that takes away the ability to see. Does that happen?
Yes.
Okay. Then a child suffers some sort of brain inflammation or brain injury that takes away the ability to see. Those are similar symptoms with very different causes.
Right.
So is that what you're saying?
I understand what I understand the case that you've described of vision can be lost at any age. Okay. What's different in a condition like autism is from the vision analogy is that most people think a big part of the problem in autism is that the connectivity of the brain is not right. And, you know, you've probably heard other people say that, and you'll hear Casanova say that, that the connections that are formed aren't right. It's not that they have big holes in their brains, you know. It's for some reason, the connections didn't form properly. And that process, that basic process, is going on like crazy in the embryo, okay, and in the first few months in utero. By the middle of gestation, things like cell migration are complete, and now the final stages of making connections can occur. There are connections being made probably throughout life, but the basic ones are set up, the basic tracts, the basic pathways, the connections between the two sides of the brain and the forebrain with the hindbrain, etc. Those pathways are all present soon after birth, so that a disruption to disrupt those pathways would have to occur early. And what I have trouble imagining, just from picturing the development, that long series of events, is that you could then go in later with some kind of global injury that would give you exactly the same misconnected brain that you can produce early.
So if you took my two children, the one with the prenatal injury and the one with the postnatal afterbirth injury, and you looked at their brains, even though the symptom is the same, neither of them can see, the mechanism, what we would see in their brains would be very different.
Well, they wouldn't necessarily have brain problems. They wouldn't necessarily be blind because there's something wrong with the brain.
Well, maybe I'll come up with another example that is okay. Something wrong with the brain. Ataxia, perhaps? What I'm trying to get at, and obviously doing it inarticulately, is do we see similar symptoms with different brain neurophysiology? That is, you've described to us what happens, the missing baskets, the absent Purkinje cells. Can you get similar symptoms with a postnatal insult that do not necessarily involve those findings?
I don't think we know the answer to that. I think it depends. It would depend on whether the behaviors you're looking at are ones that the underlying problem is one of connectivity, or just one of pure structure. I mean, for example, you could be blind because the retina failed to develop. You could be blind because the occipital cortex failed to develop. You could also be blind because somebody hit you on the back of the head and damaged your occipital cortex. And those would have the same symptoms, but through different kinds of mechanisms.
And so histopathologically, if you looked at the brain, you would see different, there would be different findings.
Yes.
Okay, that was what I was trying to get at. This is not the only explanation for autistic symptoms, this early, and I'm talking about autistic symptoms, not a diagnosis of autism.
Yes, that's right.
So you could develop autistic symptoms postnatally without having the same histopathologic findings in the brain that you've described through other mechanisms than those you've described.
Yes.
Those are my questions.
Any questions? Any further questions based on Special Master Vile's questions?
Not from the petitioners, thank you.
All right then, Dr. Rodier, we thank you very much for your testimony. You're excused at this point. Are the respondent ready to go with call the next witness then at this point?
Yes, sir.
Do we need a break? Or
could we have a brief break just to get set up, sir?
Okay, how long do you need?
5 minutes, sir.
5 minutes? Okay, we're going to take a 5-minute recess.